Hello and welcome. I'm Sam Harris, and it is my true honor and pleasure to host you here on the Growth Mindset podcast. I talk to amazing individuals about how they achieve their dreams and break down the strategies it takes to lead explosive tech businesses to being paid to travel the world. I deep dive into topics such as Bitcoin and fintech, or just how to get stuff done, with the goal of increasing our own collective wisdom and making us all happier, healthier, and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Today, we have our first French guest and an absolute sweetheart, Antoine Blondeau. He is the founder of Centum Technologies, one of the world's leading AI businesses, and he built the core tech behind the product that went on to become Siri. He is one of the advisors at Xerath AI, where he gives some brilliant mentorship. It was really great to finally meet him in person, and the first thing he wanted to know was how I was and what I was up to, irrelevant of talking about the podcast, which, seeing as we hardly know each other and he's a pretty busy guy, just goes to show the level of character he has. We cover some awesome topics about the future and the past, and dealing with problems at a personal level to threats facing the whole of humanity, and there's some huge ideas that kind of made my head spin at the time, and I can't wait to share with you. So relax and please enjoy the show.
Yes, my name is Antoine Blondeau's full name. I was born in Paris many years ago, left when I was 19, went to study in Japan at the time, then did most of what I did working in the technology sector for a while. In Japan, in Hong Kong, and in the US. And here I am now, both an entrepreneur and an investor in the AI machine learning space.
Okay. How did you always want to go to Japan, or was it just a random, there was a really interesting opportunity in terms of what you could be learning there?
Yeah, when it comes to me, you know, a few things are random. It's not that I don't like to be surprised. Actually, I do, but I usually have goals and I try to get there. And then I'm opportunistic along the way, very opportunistic. And so things change very quickly. But Japan was well thought through. We, back in the 80s, late 80s, when I was completing my studies, Japan was doing well. And at the time, I was trying to find something that would challenge me. And I thought, well, I can always get to the US. I had been to the US. US had a strong attraction to me in many ways, but I thought it would not challenge me as much as Japan would. And so I made the decision to go there. At the time, there was no much choice. You could go to the US or Japan. When it came to going outside of Europe, there was no China, there was really no India. Very little to choose from, aside from those two, you know, developed economies where you could be challenged. And for sure, Japan was more of a challenge in many ways, culture, language.
Yeah. So you learned the language?
I did. I did learn the language. I thought I had learned it before going into the country. And then I realized that what I had learned was, you know, fairly useless.
Yeah.
And so I had to do the hard work of learning it on the job or, you know, on the study or,
yeah, so you were studying in Japanese whilst learning it.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Wow, so did you have really bad grades initially, or you managed to do all right?
I think they were really kind with people like me.
That's good.
Showing some of the traditional welcoming spirit of the Japanese people.
Nice. Did you learn any lessons from Japanese then, in, like how you treat others or conduct yourself?
Japan was an extraordinary lesson in life, especially back then when they were leading the world in many ways. When I was in Japan back then, it felt a bit like science fiction. Topical, it felt like Blade Runner, but the old movie, the 1982 movie, it felt a bit like that sometimes. And I had many, many great moments in Japan. I learned many things. One of the things that I really learned was racism. For the first time in my life, I was subject to racism, and that taught me a huge lesson about, you know, what is it, how people deal with differences, and how difference creates fear, and totally irrationally. And no matter how good I was at Japanese, for example, from time to time, I would be subject to racism, which was extraordinarily educational for me. I can tell you, I always considered myself as tolerant, but post that experience, I became extremely liberal from a social standpoint.
Yeah. Okay. So then how were people racist exactly?
They were not openly racist in that they would not insult you in any way, but it was subtle and very clear once you understood the clues.
Mm. Then they just didn't think you were capable, or?
Yeah, it was capability. It was, I think, more about it was more a question of you don't belong here, and and you feel that if you enter a store,
yeah,
if you want to get a taxi, if you are spoken to, and sometimes they would speak to you in a very differential language, differentially, and being like uber nice, which was nice, and sometimes the opposite. Japan was, I think, it still is a fairly closed and country, but it was a very strong tradition of culture, and generally super welcoming. I love the country. However, there is a perception of difference creates reactions that are sometimes very emotional and not always get the words the right way.
Interesting. Okay, so can we go into sentient technologies, what you're working on now? Can you introduce the company briefly and how it came about?
Sentient technologies is the result of years of exposure to what I would call the algorithmic science and how to apply this to real business level applications. And the genesis of sentient goes way before sentient, when my co-founder and I were working on what eventually became Siri. We had a very novel approach to natural language processing at the time. This was in the early 2000s, believe it or not. And we were able to scale the process of natural language processing application development in a way that nobody had done before. One of the reasons we were able to do that was because we were applying both a architecture for NLP that was novel, intelligent agent based, sort of an ontological as opposed to grammatical approach. But also we were reinforcing this with a reinforcement learning algorithm. So we were using evolutionary computation to improve the accuracy of these intelligent agent networks when we were asleep, so overnight.
Yeah.
So we'd come in the morning, the NLP performance was a little better.
Cool.
It was quite fun.
Yeah.
And so that was the genesis. So when, after we sold that company to Sybase, and I worked for Salesforce for a while, I saw there's something that we can do here. Is there this approach? Nobody was talking about AI machine learning by then, right? This is 10 years ago. But is there something we can do here where we can begin to scale the process of generating increasingly higher or better levels of intelligence? And so to me, the idea was, let's take a parallelizable learning algorithms, a set of learning algorithms, then distribute that across many nodes, many compute nodes, so that you can harvest an enormous amount of compute over time. And then as you do that, arguably, you can handle more dimensionality than anybody else can handle typically. And therefore, you can solve problems that nobody else can solve. That was the idea 10 years ago, which I fast forward to now. In many ways, Sentient has become that company that I envision, which is massively scaled distributed AI platform that harvests enormous amounts of compute, that translates that into the evolution of more intelligent AI constructs, and applies this to different types of businesses. In our case, finance, insurance, finance, e-commerce, digital marketing, and then agriculture and healthcare.
Okay, how might you explain the difference between sentient and like DeepMind that we might be aware of?
There's no fundamental difference in the philosophical approach that we take.
Okay.
In that, DeepMind is a deep reinforcement learning approach to the neural network science. Sentient is a deep reinforcement learning approach, though we don't use the same self-learners.
Yeah,
we use evolution. But we also apply this to neural networks, not only, but also other things, but to neural networks as well. It's a process called neural evolution. So philosophically, Demis's approach and our approach is very similar. The way we apply it is quite different. We're trying to build a business.
Yeah.
Demis, clearly had a 5-year roadmap to build first the critical mass of the best possible PhD students you would get in Europe, and then build value upon that and eventually scale a business. But in our case, we tried to do that a little earlier.
Okay. So for listeners, Demis is the CEO of DeepMind.
That's correct.
And then this leads nicely into what my next question was going to be, was how did you go about, so you always had like the business case first to raise money for, or did you literally solve the business problem straight away and made money and never need to raise? Or can you explain how you built where you are?
The way we built our own staircase to our own lighthouse, right? And by the way, when we are nowhere near the, we arrived at the lighthouse just yet, was by doing two things at the same time. One was building deep technology. So we always believe that in this space, it's important if you work at the science and at the tech level. It's really critical to our DNA. It's our DNA. But also in the process, ensuring that we, along the way, were able to show the value of what we had built tangibly. Mm. And so, for example, you know, our goal was eventually to, one of our goals in our finance group was to build sort of the full-blown, all-encompassing, all-knowing artificial trader.
Yeah.
Sounds like a huge goal. It is a huge goal. Yeah. But so how do you get there, right? So you don't get there overnight. You don't even get there in 2 years or 5 years. It's just way too ambitious. However, what you can do is you get, can get to first base. And the first base for us was, can we build a day trader that will outperform? And can we build it from scratch? Can we have this giant group of machines, these millions of CPUs we had, or we have, and thousands of GPUs, can we actually apply them in concert to evolve? Not an all-encompassing trader, not God of the markets, but a decent day trader. And we're able to do that. And when we're able to do that, that's, you know, nobody had done this before.
Yeah, how long did that take?
A long time. It took, I would say it took three to 4 years.
Okay. How big was the team working on it?
I self-financed for most of that time, and which was a lot of work, a lot of belief as well.
Mm.
The team at the time was about 15 people, 12 to 15 people.
Okay, that's a lot of money then.
Sizable.
Yeah, okay, that's impressive. Cool. And then I watched one YouTube video which said you're in stealth mode, and then you kind of came out of stealth mode, so you're in like a very generic name.
Yes, we had a generic name. Actually, it's called Genetic Finance. People thought we were some form of genetic engineering company.
Yeah, that's cool.
Biotech, some stuff.
Yeah.
And then we stayed under the radar for as long as we could, meaning until we were about 40, 45 people.
Mm. Wow, that's a big company. And then, so how were you raising money for that? Was that after that you were making money?
So we were raising money. So we did a number of rounds before we got out in the open. So we did, I think we did raise something like 35, something like this, until we actually got ready to talk about us more meaningfully.
Okay. And then, so when you went public, was that because you wanted to do a bigger raise or just because you're ready to like sell a lot more?
The reason why we began to talk about ourselves when we raised our large round was because we needed people. And by then, you know, we're 45, 50 people. We had exhausted the network of really good people you have around yourself. So we had to go to the next level, and that required us to be known.
Yeah.
So that's why we decided to begin to communicate. And that's what we did.
Makes a lot of sense. So before then, were you hiring people from like your network then? So?
Mostly before, it was friends of friends, whatever.
Okay. Yeah, I do find it interesting how people recruit. So after that, you then just to check on anyone, well, as in you're just more public about what is your favorite interview question when you interview someone?
My favorite interview question is, if I asked your friends, your former colleagues, your bosses, your subordinates, how they would qualify you, what would they say? And I usually ask folks to give me the top three qualifiers. And it's interesting because what it gets people to think is how they're perceived.
Mm.
And it's a harder question. It's an even more interesting question in my view to answer than what do you believe are your strengths and what do you believe are your weaknesses.
Yeah.
It's really whether you are acting upon your strengths and also showing your weaknesses with others.
Yeah, that's much more profitable actually for any employer anyways than what do people perceive as what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. Okay. If I asked your previous employees or colleagues what your top three qualifiers were, what would they say?
I think they would say driven, ambitious. Maybe it's the same thing.
It's
close. Honest and dedicated. So it's, I think there are three things. I have ambition. I'm very honest, I believe. Not just with others, but with myself. And I really work hard. That's the good things. The bad things, I can tell you a few bad things too.
Yeah, very nice.
Stubborn.
Mm-hmm. That's like a good weakness.
It's a good weakness, but sometimes, I mean, it can be very blinding.
Yeah.
So stubborn. I think that it goes with it too, but flexibility, I think, is adaptability. It's really critical in this world, very important in this world. And I don't think it's something that I have in me that is natural. It is something that I've acquired.
Yeah.
And if I could be more flexible, more adaptable, I'd be better.
So how did you acquire that skill? Because that's a perfect growth mindset topic. Like, so you identified yourself as not being adaptable enough.
So I think it was through challenges.
Mm.
I don't think it was that smart to be able to reflect upon my lack of adaptability. It was more through challenges and being willing to apply or maybe being forced to apply for lessons learned. When we talked about Japan earlier, when you go to Japan and, you know, every day can be a struggle at the beginning. Then obviously it gets you to question yourself in many, many ways. And so I think that the good thing is that I was willing to be questioned, and that has forced me to adapt to the forcing function more than any thoughtful way to appreciate how inflexible I might have been.
Okay. Do you have any form of self-practice, like meditation or self-improvement, or do you have regular check-ins with your founder and co-founder about ways you can be better?
So no to any meditation or self or reflection upon myself that I would do on my own time. However, I seek feedback a lot, and I still believe that I do not seek feedback enough. I think feedback is the best way to improve. But certainly, and so what I've done, Sentient was very interesting. I engage consultants who are from the Table Group, you might have heard of them, to help us work on our culture. And it was very interesting, and to me, a huge eye-opener. How culture is, I always believed culture was very important.
Yeah.
But how quickly and how well you can improve upon a culture within short was very impressive to me.
Okay, what were the main improvements they executed?
It was all about communication, trust. Because communication, trust, honesty in the feedback loop, engage in constructive conflict, all related topics and concepts, but when applied together, extremely powerful.
Okay, so can you give like an example? So you have like more regular check-ins, like?
Yeah, we already did, startups do all hands, so we already did that. But one thing we did that was, I think, very effective was we began to systematically at every meeting make sure that we had we were not leaving any stone unturned. Mm-hmm. There was no underlying agenda, no hidden agenda. Everything was on the table. A.
Yeah.
B, that we were proactively asking each other whether we had left any stone unturned. And then at the end of the meeting, we'd systematically do a very quick feedback on how the meeting went.
Yeah.
Was it a good meeting? Was it a bad meeting? Or was it good? Or is it bad? Anything we can do to improve. And if you do that systematically, you get extremely good results over time.
Yeah. I've really found that when I was at Cloud Emotion as project manager or product manager, running all the sprints, and I think implemented like doing like a resonate for it. At the end of the year, you round with the sprint, and then you have like the half an hour reviewing what happened 2 weeks, what went wrong, can we improve?
Yeah, exactly.
It just made everything so much more effective going forwards.
And if you do it in context, just right after, as you do this meeting and just right after, it's just very fresh in people's mind, right?
Mm.
And there's no way, I mean, there's almost never any meeting or any interaction that is perfect. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. Right?
So it behooves people to actually find what we did that could be improved upon.
Mm.
Right?
Nice. Cool. Okay, so back to Sentient and what you guys are doing. What's, if you could only have one focus for what you do with the AI, what would it be?
It would be at the application level, the type of things that we have done and launched recently, the last, let's say, year or so.
Mm-hmm.
We released a product called Ascend.
Okay.
And that product enables you to turn a static property, a website, into something that now is dynamic. So if you think about websites and how people look at them, you know, it's very much like entering a store, a brick and mortar store. You know, the walls don't change.
Mm.
and doors don't change and the decor remains the same day in, day out. And we have not really leveraged the capabilities of the internet to give us that, to deliver that flexibility. And so what happens here is we sort of a way to begin to engage the audience so that we do sort of an A-B testing on multiple levels of steroids.
Yeah.
And turn your web property into something that's dynamic. And if you think about this, it means not only you engage with your audience, and so design in partnership with your audience, effectively, that's what it is eventually, even if you operate within your own brand guidelines.
Sure.
But it's also the ability to, for the virtual world to begin to conform to us humans opposed to the opposite. And that is what gets me excited, because what applies to website can apply to anything, advertising, content, anything. And that's the first, in my view, the first real opportunity we have to actually have intelligent design, no religious connotation here, intelligent design be at the heart of how we interact with this world.
Yeah.
So that's what I would focus on.
Okay. How long do you think it would be before, like IMDb sort of, it just has like the ratings of like the population on a given movie, but before that's smart enough to know instead what the rating would be for me, because of, if I already know what my ratings are, it should actually be able to tell me what I would think of a new movie coming up based on other people who always vote like me who have voted on it. And then if I was to go to my mate's house and a bunch of friends were about to watch a movie, could it then work out what the best movie is between all of us?
Yeah.
That we should watch.
Yeah, I think so. Today's recommendation engines are very simple.
Mm.
And they're based on what you just mentioned, you know, past behavior or cohorts based categorization of, you know, your patterns of behavior.
Yeah.
And it's very limiting, because it does not take into account the most important thing, which is how you feel right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So the question is very pertinent in that today it's really not yet happening. Ascentient actually did deliver something that begins to address the user intent in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Approach in, for example, in shopping, where we're able to infer intent based on, you know, a simple gesture, someone clicking on an image, right? So if you click on an image, just like you would do a gesture in a brick and mortar store, I like that. Mm-hmm. And then in real time, in a physical store, the sales associate is able to curate based on that input, a selection that is relevant to you. And yet the person doesn't know anything about you. Just because you said, oh, I like this pair of shoes, he or she is able to do something that's really smart, actually, most of the time. So why are systems not intelligent that way? Well, because they have not been deployed to be intelligent that way. And I think one step we did was to begin the process of having a system understand what is it that you like in a picture that you've clicked on and that you did not like in a picture that you did not click on, and begin to, through a visual dialogue, enter into something that is much more satisfying. That, to me, this is not science fiction. This can be done. Will it soon know what type of movie you like at any given time, or what type of movie you and your friends want to watch at any given time? Maybe not immediately, but I don't think that's science fiction at all. Within 3-4 years, I'm sure you have that.
Yeah, it's something I wanted to be working towards, like crowd animation, taking in user intent.
Yes. I think that's the key, much more than trying to categorize your behavior. The truth is people are changing, circumstances are everything, context everything.
Okay, cool. And then what about your plans in medicine? You have quite a lot there.
Yes, so we like medicine because it's about, obviously, saving lives.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like medicine because it's overly, maybe for a good reason, regulated. And so go-to-market can be horrendous.
Yeah.
So we did a fantastic proof-of-value project with MIT, where we were able to predict the onset of sepsis 30 minutes ahead of time, which enables the doctors to actually save you before you get infected. Sepsis is a blood infection. And it roughly kills you half the time. And it happens, most of the incidents of sepsis are in ICUs and hospitals. And in the American ICUs, it's the number one cause of mortality. So it's a big, big issue. The telltale sign of sepsis is a massive drop in blood pressure. That's why you go to the ICU, you're hooked up to a blood pressure machine. Problem is, once it's detected, you still only have 50% chance to make it. So the question was, can we give the practitioners what they need from us, which is 30 minutes, so 30 minutes head start. And that's what we were able to give them with 91% accuracy, which is phenomenal. But that system won't be deployed for a while, simply because of regulation.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
Yeah. What does the system
recognized that comes on before the blood drop?
It looks at the blood pressure at a very high frequency. It looks at it at a sample rate of 125 milliseconds. And, wow. And it's able to, based on this, it's able to build representative indicators of the waveform, if you will. And then in a combination, cell develops rules that are telltale sign of a catastrophic event 30 minutes out. So it's very much like trading, same approach, right? Except that in this case, you're not trading the price of a stock, you're predicting a massive blood pressure drop. And it works.
Cool. Yeah, that's interesting. I think the word. Demonstrative picture.
Yeah.
I get it. Cool. Yeah. Okay, thank you. If you could have it your way, what would the future be like?
It's a great question. Nobody has ever asked me that question, so I need to ponder a little bit.
It's okay.
So to me, it's funny, I have a picture, maybe, of what it would look like or what it would feel like. But it's a picture of a very interactive, perhaps slightly chaotic and serendipitous place where you have this hyper-communication where it's extremely easy to communicate with everybody, where we all link, if possible, at more than sort of this physical interface that we have today, which is very, very ineffective. Language is not effective, doesn't convey our thoughts as well. Yeah. And so if we had a direct brain link. Mm-hmm. So, but I guess that's, you know, getting to that place where we do have the ability to do that, but still live in those high rises and on top of each other, because that's conducive to creativity, because that's the empathy and the contact that people need. It's likely going to be a place where, well, you ask me if how I would like it to be. Well, I would like it to be, I would like it where a lot of the health issues are resolved and we live very long, because dying is a huge waste of resources and experience. But at the same time, here's the caveat. I think before that happens, I think we'll have issues.
Yeah.
Significant ones.
Okay. What? Yeah. I never really thought about thoughts pre-speaking, but it's really true. I used to have massive issues speaking in general.
It's a very slow interface. Yeah. Think about it. Imagine if we could communicate at the speed of our brains.
Mm.
First of all, brains accelerate, right? Because we would not be focused on delivering the speech.
Thinking like half your thoughts and making it into speech.
Speech or text, whatever it is, exactly. So right. So I think there is a big opportunity here for the human species to actually become a lot smarter, just without altering the hardware so much, just plugging it in better ways.
Mm.
Altering the hardware for humans is hard. It's complex biology, and but at least the communication protocol, if we could alter that, I think we'd get a huge boost in terms of our collective intelligence.
Yeah, yes, that'd be awesome. Have you read a lot of ideas behind this, or are you just sort of thinking about the box when you came up with this idea?
I'm always interested in trying to overcome our limitations. And so I know that I'm not the only one to have thought about this. Some other people have, for sure. But it's something that I thought about years ago, decades ago, I would say, when I was half my age.
Mm. Yeah, I was definitely thinking about like the hyperloop and stuff when I was like a kid, just like why did it take so long to get to my grandparents? Like and I had like all these images and stuff in my brain, and like actually a lot of people think these things. But I didn't have it about language, which is kind of weird because it was actually a big problem for me. But I generally try to, like, if something annoys me as a problem, either accept it if I can't change it or think about how to change it.
Yeah, and the other issue is language. Language is also a disruptor of thought, because it's limiting. It's also just part of the story. It doesn't necessarily tell you emotions as well, because facial expressions and gestures are important. It's limiting. And think about how language, it's a classical thing. When you're on the phone, we all know that being on the phone is not as good as being next to one another, right? So it's, and yet the language can be as expressive. It is just that it's it does not contain enough within it to convey the whole thing.
Yeah, so many texts where you mean one thing and the other person to be opposite end.
That's exactly right. So email is such a poor form of communication, isn't it?
Definitely. Cool. Okay. On a slightly different topic, what do you think about the fact that as we're building AI and it's potentially going to have such a huge effect on humanity that there isn't many women in AI.
So it's a problem that there are not enough women in AI, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah. I was watching, after I watched a series of your videos, this thing came out, like this hour-long conference with like all the leading researchers in AI, and it's just like a panel of like 15 men. And you're like, there's one woman there?
No, it's a problem.
Yeah.
I know a few women entrepreneurs in the AI space, but not many. I think it's a broad computer science issue.
Yeah, sure.
It's not AI machine learning. It probably is very apparent in machine learning in the AI space. I see no reason why they should not be successful.
Mm.
And there's certainly, even though I can't really point to it, but it's certainly some form of bias. And it's unfortunate. It has to change. Generally, women are massively underutilized resource in our community anyway, generally. But that's just one more example.
Okay, cool. Do you think it could influence the way we build AIs at all? And some kind of the way we think about building them? Like women have different sort of outlooks on emotions? And
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if women would change the way we build AI. They might decide to apply it to other types of applications first. They might also go about it in a more pragmatic manner. That's a trait typically associated with women, but I don't want to stereotype.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, really. But what I know, though, I think that's the critical point here, is that diversity is creativity. And in this world, you need, and I repeat what I said before, you need to be adaptable in order to survive and thrive. Adaptability comes from creativity. And so more creativity, more adaptability will come from diversity. And it's just not women. It's having a diverse workforce, diverse people, different ethnicities, different cultural backgrounds. All of that yields creativity. And I think there's in some way, and maybe not perfectly because we just talk about women, in some ways, I think that's one of the major assets of Silicon Valley, the fact that it's such a diverse place. Not diverse enough, we just talked about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's, the US generally is the coasts are a massive melting pot. And I think that is giving the US, I think, an unfair but deserved competitive advantage against a lot of the world.
So is that, I think, one of the reasons why you went there? You started it in Asia or here, or has it always been on
both sides? It's been both sides. I started in Japan, then I was briefly in Germany, and then went to Hong Kong, and then back, and then to the US. I'm a firm believer in the US economy as a system. It's a meritocracy. It gives entrepreneurs the ability to try. It authorizes them to fail and then try again, fail and try again. And that's really what matters. So failure is part of the lessons that you have in a Silicon Valley. I usually say that Silicon Valley is a lesson in failure. It is true, because out of all the failures comes great lessons, and great lessons breed great companies.
Yeah, I was watching a video where they called it the 10,000 experiment rule. Not the 10,000 hour rule to be a genius or something, but actually just trying and trying again, constantly looking at different ways.
Yes.
I liked it.
Yeah, diversity helps.
Yeah. Right?
So yeah,
cool. So I first met you through when I was working at Automorph, and you were always really good at kind of seeing the bigger picture of what was going on and to give us more accurate advice, maybe than some other people we spoke to. Is that a skill you've always had, you think, or did you acquire it along the way?
I'm not sure I know the answer. I feel like I had it for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think I had it for a long time, not because I was inherently intelligent, but I think because I was curious growing up. And when you're curious, you have to look for, you have to understand more of the world, right?
Mm.
And understanding more of the world and having this general exposure, I think, makes you make connections or inferences that are not necessarily obvious to others. So I think it's that curiosity that got me to trying to understand more.
Okay. So do you think that kind of
connect the dots, maybe?
Yeah. And so you think that helps a lot in your business, is in the curiosity that's led to all the things you've done?
For sure. Yes. I mean, the goals in my life were clear. The journey was completely serendipitous, that because of what you just mentioned, curiosity was the thing that got me to try things when they were not that obvious.
Okay. Cool. was going to ask later, but we're talking about girls stuff from when you're younger. Do you have any favorite childhood memories?
Childhood memories? Yeah. Favorite? I have an interesting memory of my childhood, which is, it would be odd to call it favorite, but it's it definitely marked me. I'll actually mention two. Yeah, it's a, no, I push it to 6:15. So I will start this, yeah? So I will talk about perhaps two childhood memories. One is a favorite, but you might think why. So I was camping with my parents and my brother and sisters in a place in the middle of the woods in Holland. And it was a very large place, forested. And my brother and I went to wash ourselves. And then on the way back, we played sort of a hide and seek. And we got lost. And we got lost in the middle of nowhere. And you know, night was falling and all this, and so it's this big forest, and you got lost. And it's like in the Middle Ages, you're thinking, you know, what's going to happen to us? And you know, and then we eventually managed to get to a road and follow the road to the entrance of this very large camp, and then go back in. And then by then, the whole camp was looking for us. They organized the parties, search parties, and all this. And to me, it's. That childhood memory is about me and my brother, my younger brother, just not obviously understanding we were not in a good situation, but not losing our sanity and, you know, finding a way to overcome the problem. Exactly. So that's one. The second thing is my grandfather was a very smart person who got injured in the war, and he actually lost his eyesight. And he was a remarkable man in many ways. And he, an example to most of us, he actually, after being blind, he completed the engineering school that he was admitted to. He was the best one in France, actually. And he went to marry, had five kids, adopted one, and then went to run his own company, which ironically, of course, was in the business of producing lights, you know, light bulbs. There you go. So, and I used to play with him chess, and he's a blind man.
Yeah.
And he was playing chess. He was representing the chessboard in his head. And I played with him many, many, many times. And that told me something about, again, overcoming, but this time it's overcoming something that's totally unfair, you know. But just through sheer will and also benevolence in his case. He was a benevolent guy. He was not trying to impress anything upon you, just trying to engage, but doing some remarkable things in the process. That was very cool.
Yeah, it's insane. Wow, thank you very much for sharing. Beautiful. Cool. Okay. And then on the notes of sort of lessons and things, what's your favorite parable?
My favorite what? Parable?
Parable, yeah. Like, if you don't have one, you can come out with some other memories. I'm quite liking you.
Yeah, I don't have a favorite parable.
Right. Yeah, do you have, I guess we've always worked on quite a few lessons.
Lesson that I've learned?
Yeah.
So there's one big lesson that I learned along the way, and that is, do not focus on status. Do not focus on the money in the bank. And I discovered that, I guess, through trial and error. Maybe in this case, trial and not error. But the interesting thing is that for most of my career, whenever I moved from jobs to jobs, it's almost always the case in every single thing that I've done, I moved to positions or jobs or companies that would pay me less than the job I was in before. But belief carries the day, right? So if you believe in it, and if you work your ass off, and if you have conviction, I think that's important. Then that turns into better. That turns into opportunities that you could never have dreamed about. And I think, to me, that's a big lesson. It's not about, you have to make the ends meet. Okay, I think that is clear to most. But beyond that, what's really important is you do what you really believe in. If you can, if you have the skills to do that, if you're fortunate enough to be in a position where you can choose something you believe in, right? In the developed world, at least some of us can choose this way. If you can choose that versus choose what's going to give you a bigger paycheck or a bigger name. Eventually, this is what's going to carry you and carry everybody else along the way.
it's very interesting. You know, when you like read like a book or something, it tells you something that you're sort of doing already, but you haven't realized you're doing it. Like, there's more of a process behind this. And I've only ever taken jobs that were kind of like entry level, which is like more interesting in a space that I didn't know about or wasn't that qualified for. So I've always like gone down kind of on purposely, but just for seeking like kind of interesting opportunities more than like, hey, but I haven't like analytically told myself that's what I'm doing. But it's like, yes, so it's good to hear that I'm doing things right. On paper, it looks like I'm doing it wrong.
It makes complete sense to me.
Yeah.
On what you just said, but you know, I think it's the same for me. I mean, it's not that I solved for that at the beginning. It just happened that I took it in job A or job B. That
yeah.
You know, it. But I think it's always worked out for me.
It's good to hear. Thanks. Maybe random. Your French, do you have a favorite cheese?
Yes. My favorite cheese would be French cheese called Brie.
Ah.
It's mild. I'm not a big fan of smelly French cheese.
Not the Roquefort?
No, not that guy.
Wow. So you, of all the cheeses, you actually only have like quite a small collection that you enjoy then?
I like cheese. I'm not a quintessential Frenchman who just loves his cheese. I love cold cuts though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That I love.
Wine?
To collect. Okay. Not to drink that much. No, I'm not.
Really?
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem a bit pointless?
As an asset class. I like wine as an asset class. That's about it.
Yeah. That's funny.
I think wines are great, but I think like everything you really need to enjoy it. To really, you know. So I enjoy it. I enjoy a casual drink.
Mm.
But if you ask me whether I prefer beer or wine, I like both.
Yeah, it's like the classic joke of like a glass of Coke is still going to be tastier, and you're like, well,
yeah,
probably.
I'm not a big foodie guy.
Okay,
to me, it's food is food and drink. Food and drinks are utilitarian.
Yeah,
okay. More than anything.
Do you ever have Huel or like Soylent, those kind of things, where it's like a meal in like a shake and that has like everything the body needs kind of thing? Or
that would be not that far. Maybe I should try that. Yes.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah,
but like the
efficient and
that stuff in the fridge. You have to think about things. I did like a week trial of it when I moved to Brussels first, and it was that I went to learn coding, and it was quite refreshing in that you never went shopping or you never had any thoughts about what you might be eating later or what you need to use or whether you need to like buy from something, because if there was no option, it was literally like I'm just gonna like pour this into a shake and drink, and then that's that.
I think the future might look like that too.
Yeah, it's interesting and more sustainable. It's like vegan and
high
protein and things. Okay, so gone into a few past things, but is there anything in your past that if you could go back and change, but still keep the memory of and not have any other future like butterfly effects that would change down the line apart from this one thing, is there anything you would go back and not do?
Yes, but I can't tell you.
Okay, is there anything that you would go back and not do that you could tell me about? Or is there anything that you would do in my opportunity you could have taken?
I can tell you one thing that I believe I should have not done. And that's another lesson. And it's back to this those formative years of my life when I was a young adult and being in Japan. Because I really tried to conform, to belong. And in doing that, you begin to lose yourself. And I think after 5 or 6 years there, I was a different being, and I was not me. I was the projection of me. And I think in doing that, I think I hurt people and I hurt myself. So if I had been more confident in myself, I would have been able to manage that better. And my wife was the one to rescue me effectively. But it took that courage, and she was not my wife at the time, but it took that courage and that reach that she had to, you know, extract the natural out of that persona that I had. And I think that was not a good, that was the difficult time of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I was able to, someone was able to overcome that for me.
Yeah.
If you will.
Do you think you needed to conform first to be able to learn to not conform?
That's a great question. Perhaps, right? Perhaps it's possible that you need to make a mistake to recognize it. Certainly I do recognize it now. And I think I'm a better person for it, for sure. So it's possible, yeah, you make a good point.
I was just thinking, like, when I was younger, I maybe wasn't always the most popular kid and things. And then, like, when I got to about 16 and suddenly I just became a lot better at talking, like I said, I wasn't so good at it. And I did become, like, really cool and conformed and was sort of, like, the kid. And then by the time I was 20, I just sort of stopped caring about anyone and, like, definitely became very much like, well, this is things I like doing and how I am and it doesn't really matter. And, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite possible that there is this conflict between the individual and society, and then you have to find, you have to be extreme in both to eventually find the balance.
I remember sort of my friend's like little sister was on Facebook the whole time trying to like be popular, and you're just telling her like, it doesn't matter, like, stop. But you think maybe they just have to go through the phase of conforming and being cool to realize that then it doesn't matter.
Maybe it's a fair point.
Interesting. It's a hard one to really teach to someone, but it's certainly very true. So thanks for sharing that. And do you have any favorite books?
I have a lot of favorite books. I like reading. I'm trying to think about one favorite book.
Non-fiction and fiction.
So I'll talk about two books. One which I read as a teenager growing up, which is one of the French classics, which was written by Balzac, very famous fiction writer in the 18th century. And it's called The Last Illusions, Les Illusions Perdues in French,
The Lost Illusions.
And there it tells the story of an up-and-comer, or rather someone who is deep from the province and who goes to the big world, Paris in this case, and to make it, and makes it and then loses it, everything. And so it was a great story, very interesting. More recently, I read a very interesting nonfiction book about Hedro Teller, his autobiography. Hedro Teller was the inventor of the H-bomb a very controversial figure. But his autobiography is very interesting. Two things that come to mind is all the efforts that people like him had to make to escape Europe in the 30s. And the other is in how they were welcome in the U.S. Not all of them were welcome. We know the stories, but some like him, they went and they were welcome because of their intellect. They could do things, right? And one thing that fascinated me was when they came up with a design for the H-bomb, they had to calculate whether the reaction, nuclear reaction, would boil the ocean, would fuse the ocean. Because if it had fused the ocean, they'd fuse the Earth and the whole globe would explode, right? So they calculated it. And they decided upon calculation that no, it was not going to happen. But imagine doing that. Imagine calculating whether you're going to blow up the world.
Yeah, that's cool. I read recently that, I'm not sure if it's actually true, but the fastest man-made object ever was the cap on one of like the tubes that they exploded one of the first sort of H-bomb tests in like a tunnel. And they just had like a manhole cover on it. And when they did it, they sort of had like a frame rate going really fast, and they only caught it once. So it was sort of like 3 miles up in the air in between like when they exploded and they calculated. It was going, like, I think, faster than the fastest probe we've ever made. I'm not entirely sure. It could be something else, but it's still pretty cool stuff that was going on back. And do you have any hobbies?
I read about history.
How do you read? As in, do you listen to audiobooks in the gym? Do you make a point of reading at 9 o'clock at night?
No, I wish. I read. I buy books. I love books. If you go to my place, you'll see plenty of books, and not virtual. They are clearly on the shelves. I love books, and it's this odd thing that to me, a book is knowledge. So the world is around me, so to speak, and so I can access it in some very physical way. Right, I love that feeling. And so I just take a book and I read it, and it's not fixed. I wish it was fixed. I wish I had enough time, but it's when I can. The plane, whenever I can. I would in my spare moment, I will read a few pages. And I love history because I think it does. I love history because, of course, for the lessons, but also for the experience of man and what we have gone through in our history, and what people, both remarkable and unremarkable people, have gone through.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot more into history lately. Again, I think I used to really like when I was a child, and I kind of mental phase maybe for the last sort of 7 or 8 years, not really reading that much, but and I just found it much more interesting suddenly again. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Have you read Nothing to Envy? It's a book all about North Korea.
No.
Yeah, I'm reading it at the moment, but yeah, it's stupidly interesting.
North Korea is interesting.
Yeah, it's a crazy place. So it follows like 7 main characters and like their stories and some families from back from like the end of the war to like now, the latest members of the child's like defect and stuff.
It's a true story.
Yeah, it's all based on true stories. Like, I really recommend reading it and just like this is a.
I would read it.
Yeah. Yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah, just teach you like crazy stuff that's gone on that I had no idea about, like all the starvation and like the way like they managed to keep a whole country worth of people in complete like isolation and like believing that these people that lead them are kind of gods and doing the right thing. And
that's right.
Like, you couldn't like walk into North Korea and tell people like, oh, it's fine, come to North America, because they'll just like think you're a dick kind of.
Yeah, they seem to theirs is dark.
Yeah. So they think like Americans have been doing everything, and they're actually like they have like a better life than other people. And there's some crazy moments when like this woman like runs to China, and she breaks into this person because she's kind of like half frozen. She's got through this river, and she hasn't like seen white rice in like years. And then like there's this bowl of white rice with some meat in it, like just through the gate. And she's like, "Why is there white rice here? What's going on?" And then like the dog comes and starts eating it. She's like, "How the hell can like a dog be eating like this most precious thing that I haven't been able to like see?" She's a doctor who hasn't been able to be
eating
like rice and,
in the 21st century. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a really good book.
Cool.
As you're into history, and that's a good thing. And is there anything you want to ask me as we're wrapping up?
I want to ask you one question.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if you project yourself 10 years out,
okay,
what are you doing?
10 years time? So I've been pretty good at doing most of the things that are on my list to do in terms of scale of things that I've been doing and targets and buying a flat, doing like more side projects, like did some music production when I kind of got to 25. So on my list is to write an album by the time I'm 30, have a podcast with sort of like a sizable level of people. So I'm really enjoying it. So I don't see why I would ever stop doing it. So by 10 years time, it should be a recognizable podcast across the English speaking areas. It's like a notable thing. I really want to get more into journalism and things like North Korean stuff. I'd love to actually speak to some people like that and have more like series or like sequences behind like telling more stories. So
deeper, do more research.
Yeah, I want to like do more like things. I've been applying for some things with BBC to maybe like run some episodes about stuff with them. So in 10 years time, I'll be more of a journalist, and then like my main thing I guess is business. I've constantly always been running some form of business, and so I started my first logistics company, which I ran 4 years and sold, and I've done a number of like side projects since then. But I guess I keep on trying things, like the 10,000 experiment rule. I feel like I will be doing something bigger. But I've got a few ideas I'm working on over next year. So in 10 years' time, it's hard to say exactly what, but I think I want to have finished working on anything just for the point of like money and be working on more what can I achieve with this business. So I want to go more down the line of sustainability or healthcare.
Begin to make a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a few ideas in those areas, but I'm struggling how to really launch them.
That's great.
That's
fine. You've got 10 years to do
more. Yeah. It's like, I don't know how much I need to go into depth. I should have a wife and probably children by 10 years' time. And there's lots of things to go through. Okay, I should probably stop traveling all the time and maybe we can buy more things.
Cool. That's a great answer.
Yeah. And what will you be doing in 10 years' time?
Well, hopefully I will I would have helped many people get to the next level of you know, personal success and impact.
Yeah,
that's how I'm transitioning my life from being an entrepreneur to being an investor, but just not an investor. It's someone who just gets involved and really helps people and helps entrepreneurs deliver on their potential. And that's hopefully within 10 years, I've got a few of these under my belt. They've gone on to build great things and make great impact. That's what I would like me to be.
Cool.
In 10 years.
That's great. I guess in the point of the podcast is to help people go out and explore and learn to be better themselves. So I feel that's something I'd really like to achieve by then.
Cool.
And will have achieved.
Mentality. It's going to happen. Cool. So thanks very much. And finished in time for your next meeting.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for delaying it.
Thanks so much.
Well, that was the interview. what an interesting set of stories. I really love getting more into people's stories and where they've come from. And I think it's a good direction for the podcast that I'm going to follow more in the future, as long as no one gives me feedback about how bad it is. And I wish I'd had more time to go into the founding of Siri and all that backstory, but sadly, I don't know, not enough time. Anyway, I like to break down my top tips. Number one, have a growth mindset. You can literally achieve seriously big goals if you work for them, despite any limitations you think you have. Like, his grandfather carried on with his life with a positive attitude and went on to do incredible things despite being blind and never gave up. He managed to run a successful business and carry on with personal hobbies like playing chess. Like, I don't think I'll ever forget the story of Anton playing chess with him, because it's just truly incredible. Number two, challenge yourself. Open yourself to interesting challenges and learning experiences at every point. Given the option of studying in America or Japan, choose Japan. Taking the next job up the chain versus a step down in a new avenue where you could learn a lot more. Like, take the step down and take on the set of new challenges and jump in at the deep end. And you'll learn so much faster and be a much more rounded person with way more skills. I think in general, if you're feeling fairly safe, that's a sign that you're doing something wrong, and you need to always have some challenges that you're almost a little bit scared about as to whether you're going to be able to achieve them or not. Otherwise, you're really just not trying hard enough. Number three, ask people what others say about them and don't ask about their weaknesses or strengths. I think this is a really nice insight into actually getting a more honest view of what other people perceive someone, and probably a more accurate view of their traits rather than what someone thinks is their traits, because we all live in our own world where we think we're great at stuff and maybe we don't get recognized for that because it's not something that we actually have as a trait. I could probably have explained that better, but I think you get the point. And now on to books, my favorite thing. So Antoine's first book recommendation is Lost Illusions by Honoré de Balzac. And that might be pronounced wrong, so look at the show notes if you want to find it. I've never heard of this book before, but on investigation, it sounds amazing. It seems to be considered one of the great French classics that's taught in school all over France and much more appreciated actually as an adult, but I really can't wait to read it. It seems to be a coming-of-age novel about a French man who moves to Paris to seek love and glory, and I'm hoping to just get insights onto life in France back in the 19th century, but all in the form of a beautifully written novel. So maybe I'm completely wrong, but I'm excited to read it anyhow. Then he also recommends Edward Teller's autobiography. It's called Memoirs, A 20th Century Journey in Science and Politics. So he covers the story behind the H-bomb, as well as his entire path leading up to H-bomb and after it. And also recounts the effects had on him from his relationships with great minds like Einstein, von Neumann, Bohr, and Fermi. So another book I'm just quite excited to read. And then finally, my own book recommendation was Nothing to Envy by Barbara Demick. This book had a really big effect on me, just learning how an entire society can be controlled by their rulers and that it's actually still going on today just made it feel a bit more real and worrying, I guess. And just a lot of insights into human psychology. So a truly great book that covers the story of several families in North Korea from the end of the war up until today. And possibly the best book that I read last year. Like I said, it did have a big effect on me. One of which was a massive urge to go to North Korea and just see things for myself. So I actually delayed release of this podcast as I didn't want to talk about this book until I'd been to North Korea. So I'm pleased to announce that I have now visited North Korea. It was actually quite lovely, as well as completely mind-blowing and weird all at the same time. So certainly stay subscribed to hear future podcasts on North Korea and what is going on there. And that is the end of the podcast.
You've listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to reach out, I'd love to talk to you. On Twitter, I am at SamHarrisTweets, or Instagram, SamJamSnaps.
Show notes, along with links to everything that we discuss, are available at growthmindsetpodcast.com. thegrowthmindset.com, along with information on how to get involved and blog posts on cool things that you should be aware of.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy your next podcast.